tuning in to the online broadcast network, AfterBuzz TV. Over 20 million weekly downloads in over 150 countries and your number one source for after-show entertainment. TV, the destination for TV superfans, producing aftershows for over 300 of your favorite TV shows, interviewing celebrities and showrunners, and bringing you behind-the-scenes exclusives. All thanks to E! Entertainment's Maria Menounos, producer Kevin Undergaro, and internet leader Akamai. Now, let the buzz begin!
Hey there, Fanshees! Welcome back to the Banshee After Show here on AfterBuzz TV, talking about Season 2, Episode 2, Snakes and Whatnot. I am Matt Lieberman. Join me on the panel all season long, Manus Rose is here.
Hey, what's going on?
Oriana Leo is here.
Hello.
And Isaac Johnson is here.
Hello, everyone.
And we have a very, very special guest here today, one of the main directors on Banshee, and the director of this episode, Lonnie Peristere, is in the studio with us.
Super stoked to be here, guys. Really, really happy. Love
thanks
your show.
Thank you so much.
Super stoked to have you. So this episode, building on a very, very strong premiere and continuing to kind of spin out our plot lines and kind of we're solidifying, I think, what's going to be the main threads of the first half of this season. We have the conflict between Kai and the Red Bones. Yep. We have the conflict between, you know, the Red Bones, the Konoha police, and the Banshee Sheriff's Department. We have Kai's mother, who is dying, and now we've got Brock's ex-wife in the mix there. We have the continuing descent of Rebecca Bowman, and we have Carrie continuing to struggle with her role in this society. Who am I supposed to be now? I don't have to be this waitress. I feel so stuck. So a lot of stuff going on, and obviously this heist. But the first thing that I want to talk about, I want to talk about Rebecca and Kai, who I felt like we kind of gave them the short shrift in the first episode, and we got to see a lot more of what they're up to this week, especially in this interesting opening visual sequence, the first departure for the series, where we're seeing the designer drugs being made. Last episode, we had some mention of the Molly sales in Philadelphia, and now we're seeing that all get produced. So, Lonnie, what was the impetus to kind of do something different visually in this episode?
Jonathan Tropper really wanted Rebecca Bowman to become the Michael Corleone of Banshee. You know? So she and Greg and Jonathan, let's push this agenda. She's like she's in line to sort of like grow big and get badass, and that was the idea there. So Jonathan had this idea, this Lord of War main title like thing that he'd seen a long time ago, Nicolas Cage, where you follow the making of a bullet.
Yes.
Right? So he's like, well, why don't we open the show with the making of an ecstasy pill, which would be like kind of the first lesson for Rebecca Bowman about how business works. Okay, come to my factory. Here's open the hood. Here's how it works. And we made that as the opening of the show. And Greg, he's like, well, you know, what if we like made that the title? You know, why don't we just try that for something different? And then sort of by doing that, we can introduce our Polaroids. Each one just tells something a little bit more about what the characters are doing. Mm-hmm. We could sort of like then lay the groundwork for where Rebecca Bowman is going, which leads into the first big set piece.
Yes.
Cool.
And we've got this great scene between Kai and Rebecca and Cage and I assume his sons. And Rebecca, what did you guys think of this scene? And what do you think of where is Rebecca at mentally right now? Because obviously we're not sure if she's sleeping with her uncle. She's at the very least sleeping next to her uncle.
Naked.
Yeah. She's confusing what love and sex are. She is a murderer now. She sees herself growing into this role as, you know, a big part of this organization.
Yeah, I've got like her worried about perception. And a lot of the characters in this episode probably worried about the perception of how they're, you know, seen. And I see her being very much worried for the perception of Kai, who doesn't really seem all that concerned with it because it's just sort of business for him. But I've got her in that headspace of being worried about his reputation, which is why she pulls out the gun and, you know, shoots Kai in the leg.
Yeah.
For me, I feel like this is the reason why you don't want to get someone who's really emotionally immature involved in a life of crime, because they become trigger happy. You know, we've already seen her kind of struggle last season with Kai's murder of, you know, Sheriff's Hood's son and all that stuff. But for her to pull out a gun and to shoot someone in the kneecaps just for saying something not so nice, not really appropriate, and not appropriate at all for what Kai's business, you know, plans are. So it just seems like she's a child and she's she's wielding this power willy-nilly, and I'm afraid of who's going to get hurt.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what I really enjoyed about this scene and I'm going to maybe say this a little bit later, too, the different styles of filmmaking. And we get a lot of different flavors of just different styles. And this particular scene, set piece, was very Tarantino-esque. I felt very like Pulp Fiction, you know, big kahuna burger.
Yeah.
You know, very true romance. Yeah. Or you know, Inglourious Bastard, just this big bloody mess, and then but also very matter of fact, boom boom boom, blood blood blood, next scene, awesome.
Guys, True Romance was all about this scene. Like, yeah. In fact, really? We talked about it. We pulled it up on the set. We threw it up on YouTube. We're like, look at this clip. Look at the whole the couch scene. Yeah. You know, because we really want this thing to go like crazy fast. Mm-hmm. Because when it happens, it's like, oh shit, these guys are going to be like,
you could have even went to the Safari Hotel right down on our tour, Pennsylvania.
We looked at it and Lily Sims was like, oh my god, True Romance is my favorite movie. We're like, good, that's good, because you're going to do this right now.
Yeah.
Well, I also thought it was appropriate though, because, you know, maybe it's not appropriate for her to pull out the gun because of those comments, but then you see Burton, who, like, would kill a mouse with a grenade. Like, he's spraying
just
everyone.
Flourish with this
stoic face. Yeah. It's just, like, another day to Burton.
Yeah, and I think just another key thing to keep an eye on here is Kai, because this is somebody who, he's never really had a true collaborator before. Mm-hmm. He has Burton, but Burton is clearly subservient, and he has made this kind of rash decision of, I have this girl in my life now, she's a part of this, I want her to be a part of this, I want to have someone who understands what I go through,
mm-hmm.
and he's realizing that maybe he made that decision a little too rashly.
Too early.
He's seeing the effects of that decision, and I think this is the peak, to me, of her involvement with this organization. I feel like as she continues to ingratiate herself and feel like, you know, I'm really big, I'm part of this, it's going to continue to create a rift between her and Kai.
Oh, interesting.
This is, to me, this is the moment where she not only oversteps her boundaries, he's saying, wait, has she just not listened to any of my training, or have I not trained her well enough, or is this just someone who's not to be trusted? And then when he hands her the gun and he's like, you know, finish what you started, she looks him right in the eye while she does it, and that's her kind of saying, like, you know, are you proud of me? This is her saying, I don't know, what is she saying in that moment?
She's pushing Kai Proctor. She's saying, not only can I do this, but I'm going to do this, and I'm going to do this while I'm looking right at you. Mm-hmm. And I'm not afraid to look right at you, because I'm a strong woman, stronger than you might have imagined.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little bit of a beware moment. It's why I used slow motion, actually, in that intercut on the way out, is because I really wanted to resonate with where Rebecca was, which was a little bit deeper, angrier, more brooding and more plotting, I think is the right word, plotting.
Yeah.
You know, she's impetuous, and she's plotting.
That's
which is why I love that little
smile.
Smirk.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I love that. And it was something that, you know, Lily kind of tried on the day, and she said, is that right? I'm like, oh yeah, that's right.
This just kind of reminded me of, I know that they're uncle and niece, but if you have a romantic relationship and you start seeing the crazy in the other person, I mean, I think Kai was really lonely, and so was Rebecca, and they've been brought together, they've chosen to be together, but it kind of reminds me of this, okay, is this what you want? Is this where it's going to go? Like that wild card that you still need the person, you want them there, they make you feel better, and yet, could this be the end of you?
But who's there for them? I mean, that's really the question we were asking them, too, is like, who's there for Kai Proctor?
Yeah.
Who's there for Rebecca Bowman? Mm-hmm. And it's kind of oddly convenient.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I thought the stylized, I thought you were going to keep that bloody beauty mark.
Yeah,
you know,
I saw that.
The remaining for the whole show, just leave that dot of blood there.
We also, this is just white clothes watch. Just,
yeah, I was going to ask.
Yeah, she was back in the white.
Was there a conscious decision
She's
to put her back
in white?
Yeah, Paisha Prouty, our costume designer, is amazing that way. And it's supposed to be a wedding concept. You know, the whole idea behind them is that Kai's always in black, she's always in white. Mm-hmm. You're going to see something coming. You're going to see a little bit of a switch, which follows through with that.
Yeah. Yeah.
But that's what you're going to see with Rebecca. She's definitely white bathing suit.
Yes, white dresses, white everything.
It's a bride and groom.
But we've seen black enter her wardrobe, and then later in the episode, she's wearing black
By choice.
Okay, all right. Another thing that's going on in their orbit is that Kai's mother, who he's really only just reconnected with, is dying, and he pulls her out of the Amish settlement. He brings her to their home, and he now has Emily Lotus living with them. Emily, who has been involved with Brock once again, and I don't know if she, you know, like the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over expecting a different result. And in her case, she's kind of got that with Brock. She keeps thinking, well, if I draw him back into the web, maybe things will change. Maybe he will take me over the job, and it'll just never, ever happen. So I have to wonder, she knows how much Brock hates Kai. Brock hates Kai more than anyone on the show, I would say. I mean, I would say Hood has good reason to hate Kai, and Chayden has good reason to hate Kai, but Brock has always been outspoken with that hatred. He's always been direct with the fact that we need to bring down Kai Proctor. I have to imagine that Emily's heard this rhetoric in their home for years.
Okay, but she also needs a job. She's feeling really sorry for herself, drinking herself to sleep every night. She needs something to do. And she's clearly really good at this. She's warm. She's kind. We see her show a kindness to Rebecca that I don't think Rebecca has received a kindness in a really long time. She doesn't even know how to accept it. So I think it's really interesting, but I also think that Emily needs this because it's what she does. It's the only thing she does right, apparently, that we know so far.
What did you guys think?
I mean, I think, I mean, first of all, with Brock, I mean, he just, they, both of them, they just need some loving. I mean, they just, I mean, really.
they're getting some loving.
And I'm really proud of Brock. I mean, he's getting some good loving these last few episodes. Now, also, I mean, you know, Emily's in, she is in the Proctor residence. Who knows, maybe Proctor might develop some feelings there if, there's going to be a falling out with Rebecca and Proctor. Maybe Emily will take, you know, Proctor's bedside. That's all I'm saying.
Now that's a pretty.
I had a question because she does ask Brock in that, or like Brock asks her, like, "What do you really want out of this? Like, what does she want out of it? If it is going to be the same situation before that, the job comes first and." You know, that he's going to put that ahead of her, and she's frustrated with it. It shouldn't necessarily be news because that's been their history.
Yeah.
What does she want?
We talk a lot about, like, histories of characters and things like that. And we definitely, and I say we, Greg, Jonathan, Adam Targum, my other co-EP, we talk a lot about, you know, who is Emily Lotus and where she come from. And, you know, we saw her as someone who was kind of raised in a broken household, you know, but maybe a drunk and abusive father type situation with it. You know, she had to, you know, get involved with at an early age and become the caregiver. And so we found her, like, even with Brock, as this guy who's this cop who's always out on the run, like someone, like Brock was somebody that she could maybe fix, you know, or put back together. She, like, has this need to, like, to put, and so she takes this job as, like, a hospice nurse so she can help families get fixed, you know. So even, you know, the worst person in the world is still someone who has a mother, who has a daughter, who has a thing. So her point is, like, from a job perspective, she is there to try to give them comfort in their weakest hour.
And it also speaks to the nature of her and Brock's relationship in that Brock was someone that she couldn't fix. It's a failure, like a big, like, red mark in her ledger, so to speak, of this man who she could not reform, who she could not fix, who will still be married and addicted to this job that's slowly killing him.
That's why we hang on her face, you know, at the end when he goes out for the call. It's like we stay with her because no matter what she does to please him, she can't get him to, you know, she can't get him there.
Powerful.
Banshee emotion.
Yeah.
I love Banshee. Well, it's like, it's one of the reasons why we love this show so much is it is elevated above what it could be. It could be this exploitative, you know, pure action and sex show, but the emotion is so rich. It's such a well-written show. It's such a well-directed show that it really is high entertainment.
I like also, I mean, you really did slightly, but still touched on it, the contrast and also of how, you know, Proctor really likes, you know, new Western medicine. I mean, obviously, you showed the old Amish ways. I mean, they were going to leave her just bedridden. I mean, and pretty much have the family doctor, the Amish doctor, just, you know, service the mom. But I mean, and I really like the juxtaposition of that.
Yeah, it's cool.
Yeah. I want to talk briefly about this, and moving into Chaitin territory.
Yeah.
This sequence where Rebecca is assaulted at her home by a couple of red bones, intercut with this sex scene. Now, before we went on the air, Lonnie, you were telling us a little bit about how you guys approached that sequence.
Well, with all the sex scenes that we have on Banshee, you know, we want them to be hot, and we want them to be great, and we want them to be visually stunning. We want all of that. But for me, as a filmmaker, as a narrative storyteller, you know, I'm constantly working with Jonathan and Greg and Adam to kind of make these things more than that. Like, what's the meaning? Why are we there? What does it mean to the episode? What does it mean to the narrative? So for me, I needed to have this scene be more than just Chaitin having a romp in the tent. I needed it to be about, you know, what's coming, his ritualistic growth from being a human being to actually becoming a god, because that's what Chaitin believes. He believes he's becoming a god.
So, I am the tribe.
Yeah, I am the tribe. Exactly. Before I go out to war, you know, how do I prepare for war? And so for me, this was a ritual that he was going to had to go through with to kind of populate the tribe, you know. So they're preparing him, they're painting him up, they're getting him ready to transcend the human spirit, and you know, it's a little dope and a little action, and all of a sudden, you know, we're in this kind of really surreal moment, which is a ritualistic sort of coming together to actually make, you know, living clones of Chaitin that are coming, you know, potentially. And I like the idea that we would do this ritualistic thing because it's as important as getting Kai and the girl. So first thing we asked ourselves is, well, why isn't he going to get the guy, the girl? Because this is more important. He has to prepare himself for the bigger war that is coming this season. It is a big one. So. Mm-hmm.
You know, and once again, going back to, like, styles, and we were talking about this prior to the show, this one, first of all, when we first see Rebecca swimming, it was very Jaws-esque, you know, just the underwater camera, which was really a cool shot. And then, you know, the segues in and out of the scenes between Chaitin and then Rebecca swimming, it was very a beginning montage of a 007 movie.
Awesome.
Yeah. Yes. Or even the opening of Barbarella.
Oh my God, that's
right?
Good.
That's good.
Oh my, yeah. Oh my. You know, I tend to overthink all of these things. I wanted it to be this French New Wave, multi-layered, like, dissolve sequence that, you know, had, that basically brought the spiritualistic thing that Chaitin was going through together with the attack, and wanted the sort of the passion of the sex and the climax to come with his guys that are passionately killing her. The sequences in the pool and using the pool actually was to sort of also show the spirituality and transcendence for Rebecca. Mm-hmm. In fact, I had her, you know, floating, and I tried to, like, put a light right over her head so she's almost like Christ-like was the idea. You know, she's sort of, and I wanted this, like, kind of very spiritual, Christ-like, pure person who's going to get attacked to be in the bowl of paint, you know, that Chaitin has and the girls were using to paint him up with, that this is a sort of a metaphorical spiritual thing. So
amazing. As Chaitin is a bit mad, as someone would say, there's not blood in that paint, is there?
No.
Okay. Oh, good question.
Just because he's cut himself before, and then it looked like he painted his face last season with blood. And
I'm wearing the shirt right now.
Yeah, there it is.
Of Chaitin in jail says, "Do I look like?"
Yeah. I just thought for a second, like, "Ooh, is he crazy enough to put blood in there?"
No, maybe. They're definitely adorning him to be a god, and I took the two women, and Chaitin's completely submissive, maybe for the first time, maybe the only time in the series. He's down and they're up, and the whole idea there is that they're bowing to the god within him, and that's how he rises. And I'm taking to the, I know, guys.
No, it's fascinating.
Yeah.
Also, I will take any opportunity for Burton to be a total badass.
Me too.
And fling that. Was it a knife or pliers? It was a knife.
Oh, it's a badass switchblade.
Badass switchblade. Bam. Loved it.
I love Bowtie Burton. Burton. Yeah. That's him.
Okay, before we move on, we got a lot more Chaitin stuff and everybody else in the cast to talk about. I need to really quickly mention iTunes. Folks, I say it every week, and it's only because it's the truth. The best way to support AfterBuzz TV is to go to iTunes, rate and review the shows that you listen to or that you watch on YouTube. It's quick, it's easy, it doesn't cost you a dime, and it supports this entire network. It's how we get our sponsors. You know, AfterBuzz TV puts out over 80 hours of free after-show content a week on multiple platforms, on audio, on video. We have incredible guests like Lonnie.
Wow.
Yes, it's a big undertaking. And the only way we're able to make it happen is from your support. Your ratings
Damn
and reviews
right.
show our sponsors that they are making the right investment, that they are reaching an audience that is engaged and pleased with their content. So the more you can help us out, the better. We have no new iTunes reviews this week, but we want to give a few quick YouTube shout-outs.
Yeah, well, I know sometimes iTunes is kind of slow to update, too. So
it's
like,
true.
You may have given us reviews, and we'll see them next week. Really quickly, it looks like, and then we debated this, it's either El Clubon or iClubon. Can't really tell, but thank you. Without Remorse 12, Simmer Down Hate 9, something like that.
Nice.
Like that Sweet Ruptured Light, that's a cool name. Sylvia Ribeiro and Andinus Davis. Thank you so much. And we're in the comments sometimes too, so we can chat with
you.
We'll
be checking the comments for sure.
The conversation never stops.
Conversation never stops. All right. So we see Tommy Littlestone for the first time since last season, and he is frustrated with Chayton because, you know, and quite rightly, because he feels that everyone is thinking that he just got a free pass because he's Chayton's little brother. He wants an opportunity to prove himself, and he feels that he hasn't gotten one. Why am I not the one who's going to go capture the girl? Which, in retrospect, be glad that you weren't one of the people. Okay, because you're still alive, and they are clearly not.
Yeah.
I had a couple thoughts about this.
Yeah, go ahead.
Did Tommy look like cracked out to anyone else?
Yeah,
he looks sweaty like he's and really on drugs.
Out, yeah.
So that wasn't just me.
No, not at all.
Lonnie.
Well, he's not, but he definitely is in that mode of sort of frustrated and dead end. He's in a dead end on the reservation.
Okay.
So it's definitely not. That though.
Okay, so it's not that. And the other thing that I loved about that shot, when he puts his hand on Tommy, when Chayton puts his hand on Tommy's shoulder, and it's like all he needs is the touch, and it imbues this power where he's now quiet and acquiescing, and he doesn't really have to say anything except for you need to be patient. And has that hand touch. And I love that it pans from the hand up to the two of them.
Do you guys have older brothers or sisters?
I'm an only.
Yeah, I do.
Yeah, so like it's something I like to do. It's like my brothers are like we constantly are putting our hands on one another. So that's something you'll see that actually. In the series.
Yeah. Oh. Yeah. We also have the first on-screen confrontation between Nola and Chayton. Mm-hmm. Nola, who returned at the end of last episode. And they have a past. We kind of get some brief flashbacks where it appears that Nola was hooked on drugs.
Yeah, or like it seemed like she tried to OD.
I loved shooting that scene. That's actually on WelcomeToBanshee.com. You can see the origin that is driven from. But it was really fun. Odette, really went for it. Mm-hmm. And kind of inside thing, our stunt coordinator, not the actual stunt coordinator guy, but the actual guy who's in the office who puts all the stuff together. He's kind of a... Never had any screen time, never had any time outside the office, and he ended up becoming the main guy in that little flashback.
Oh, man.
Oh, that's cool.
So it was a big break for him, and he did a really good job. So,
wow.
So that little, in that little flashback scene. So.
Yeah. Well,
so, Kevin Welch.
Yeah.
Kevin Welch.
I really like seeing someone who's not afraid to stand up to Chayton. I mean, no one really kind of questions his authority. Mm-hmm. And she didn't back down at all. I thought that was really cool.
You will have your blood when you say no.
Yeah, no.
Mm-hmm. I'm not fine with that. You don't call the shots around here.
It's interesting because so far in this episode and since the season started, I mean, women have no problem standing up to Chayton. Women, I mean,
standing up to people in general.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Mm-hmm. I mean, strong, badass women on the show.
Yes, but in particular, I mean, we were just speaking of just Chayton, like his Chayton's brother, bows down to him, but Nola, nope.
No, we love making that scene too. And Odette is she's such a badass chick in her own right. And Odette Annabelle, she rules the planet. And so the two of them, you have this big guy, Geno Seegers, huge. Then you got little Odette, and she just has no problem just sort of getting in his face. And I loved when she put his hand on his heart, and she literally felt his heartbeat. And that's when she realizes that he's he thinks he's something else, and that's what kind of pushes the sequence forward. Yeah, you know, it's I am the tribe.
That's so dangerous.
It is.
Yeah.
And he says, no, you're not Alex. That she feels that. No, you're something else.
I saw him making that clear distinction, too. You really distancing himself from the kind of person that Alex was versus the kind of person he is. Like, the minute that she says it, he's just like, I am not Alex. Mm-hmm. That was really cool.
Don't get in my way.
Yeah. Don't get in my way.
Well, that's the difference, right? Because Alex was a politician and a backroom wheeler-dealer, and this is a warrior.
Yeah, and possibly could be corrupted, and he's... He's like a true believer.
You know? He's incorruptible.
Yeah.
A battle we will not win.
That's true. Nola also gets to share the screen with Carrie this week in a wonderful scene. Our backwoods hicks from last week return to cause some trouble, and before Carrie can lay the smack down, Nola enters and lays some down of her very own, because she wants a slice of that apple pie, and no one's going to stop her.
Not a euphemism, maybe?
No, not a euphemism.
I don't know. I thought they were two. They were kind of sizing each other up, and for a second there, I thought there might have been
a little
mutual admiration society.
I would say that. Mutual admiration. We'll call it that.
I feel the pie was just that damn
literally,
good.
Yeah, literally,
because it had the double crust, and you know how it was raised. I mean the butter and the consistency was just it was that good. It was not your Costco type pie, okay?
Oh, of course not.
Are we getting into some restaurant fiction
here? I'm just saying it was pretty good pie.
What I love most about this scene is that they're sizing each other up, but also I have to imagine that these are two women who rarely meet an equal. A feminine equal.
There's
a lot of pleasure taken in that.
These are two good-looking, badass assassins, pretty much, that are meeting each other.
And an assassin and a thief. But still.
They both killed.
Yeah.
Carrie has been trained, though, essentially.
That's true. She's, and the first season finale, she takes out a lot of people.
Yeah. Essentially has the capability as a trained assassin.
And then Enola is just wielding the gun holster, the double gun holster, just takes off her jacket and boom,
she doesn't mess around.
She does not mess around.
Yeah. Also
this is like, come on guys, this is about two women that just absolutely admire each other. Mm-hmm. Up ways, sideways, right ways, left ways. Like, and for all the right reasons, they want to know who they are and how they got to be who they're going to be. Mm-hmm. And that's just the thing that we talked about, you know, at the table, at the diner. We're like, okay, this is the one person in town that actually you could kind of go toe-to-toe with, and it would be a good fight. And it's like, and who made you? And what made you? And where are we?
Sins of the father.
Sins of the father.
Dumbass. Yeah. Yeah. Is there also, like, maybe just a little bit of, like, I don't know, like empathy towards each other because, you know, her father just died and then her brother just died.
They're looking in the mirror.
And they've got a little bit of camaraderie there.
Sorry about your brother. Sorry about your life.
Yeah.
It was really, really cool. I hope that they get more screen time before the season is out.
Me too.
That would be very, very nice. Let's talk a little bit more about Carrie. She has to break things off with Colonel Stowe, can we talk a little bit of relationship politics here?
Okay. Relationship politics.
You don't just go to someone's place of business, come behind the counter, rip their pants off, start to eat them out, stop, and then walk away.
Yes, you do when you want to make a lasting impression.
Okay, and it was a very lasting impression.
That's what I wrote down. I was like, he clearly thinks that he does not have a hold on her, and he wants a hold on her, and he's going to do whatever he can to get it. And she probably at least thought about that for the rest of the day.
Oh, you know that she did. It was really impressive. Even you could see it on her face.
The opening of the show, she's smoking the cigarette with this look in her eye that makes it seem like she's relishing a past exciting time.
I think
I was okay with this.
She likes him. I mean, it's very clear, and the fact that he's the mark kind of sucks.
It sucks. Yeah. That's the word.
It sucks, and it's kind of working.
Yeah, she doesn't want to have to break things off. Nope. She just knows it's her responsibility, and there's Sheriff Hood in the car shame her. She's like, come on, dude. Are you really going to be this ex boyfriend?
I like what you're saying, because the shot on her face when she's telling him the reason, she doesn't want to do what she's doing. Mm-hmm. You can tell she just is like disconnecting. This is not fun. This isn't even what I mean.
And he can tell.
And she should think she should be at home with her kids and not booty calling. But I don't know that that's what she really wanted to do.
Ivana Milosevic is an amazing actress, and in any other hands, that could have been a super cheesy line delivered in a super cheesy, you know, melodramatic way. And the way she handled that, where it's just, this is, I'm telling you this, but it's absolutely not how I feel.
Right.
Yeah. The only thing about that scene that I did not understand, maybe you can help me out, is so you just leave the shot on the neck, the blurry. I mean, were we supposed to see, like, a vein pop?
Was he supposed to turn into a
No, it's actually about what he's looking at in the mirror, which is a man he can't connect with. So the idea there is that you're seeing what he's seeing, which is somebody who's completely out of focus that he can't reach. And what you hear is you hear the voices in his head, which are, like, you know, a part of his, you know, psychosis, which leads us to the end shot of the show, you know, which shows us even more
angry
about why he's angry. We also see him beat the crap out of the guy. So for me, we're starting to introduce this man's own PTSD, which is, I had a man that I used to know, and he's in that mirror, but I can't see him anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Oh. Yeah. Beautiful.
That's and awesome. Now he's just eating breakfast, thinking about PTSD
naked.
Stuff. Naked. That's just who he is now.
That's who he is.
Yeah. And obviously, I love
very sexually frustrated because it didn't happen for him. I don't know if you guys saw that. He started it going in the diner, and then they got nothing.
Yeah. Yeah, he did lay this a solid groundwork for a great time. Someone would need you to plant the idea early in the day for it to happen later.
Right?
You expected to have completion.
I don't know anything
awesome.
About this personally. But
you're right.
You know, sometimes you
he
know,
had a strategy.
If you want that to happen at night, you got to plant the seed early in the day.
Exactly.
And take notes from this man.
And just be left blue balls. Terrible.
Yeah.
Blue balls and PTSD. That's two tastes that don't get go great together.
Where are you when I need you? Where are you when I need you? I can't see you.
Yeah.
If you were here, it'd all be good.
Yeah. Exactly. I love that we get a scene where we see how he interacts with his men and someone who's cheating him, who's stealing from him, because we need to know more about what motivates this guy. Because while we understand that he's a formidable opponent, and we understand that he's a bit unstable, we understand that he's a control freak and that he's PTSD, it's good to know, not through the lens of the characters that we do know, but just as viewers, how does he even treat his own men? And it's just, this is someone who cannot be crossed ever.
Well, he even says that, you know, his worldview is that a grave injustice has been done because, you know, some patriots were left to die for politics.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like he clearly has his own, I don't know if it's a god complex as well, but he feels right and rationalized in what he's doing. And he has this past traumatic experience that is evident, is the evidence and support for what he's going to continue to do, which seems like steal from the government, protect his men. And if anybody crosses him...
Right. But what is he even going to use the money for? It doesn't seem like a guy who wants to spend money willy-nilly. He doesn't really seem to care about the quality of his lifestyle. Is he, like Chaitin, setting up a militia?
No. I think if you were to ask Colonel Stowe what he's doing, he's taking care of his men that are not being taken care of.
Yeah.
Fair enough. Period. Like that. It's really... That's what I love about Jonathan Tropper's villains is they're not black and white. I mean, this is not necessarily a bad guy in his own right. Neither is Chaitin, by the way. It's super important to know that Colonel Stowe believes that he's been wronged by the people that he used to fight for, and that these people that he's got now on this boat, as he's demilling an antiquated old base when we should be out fighting the fight, and he's taking care of these guys that have been taking care of you, you know, as a general people, and I'm going to take care of them, and that's it. That's his way.
Fair enough.
Don't get in my way.
Yeah.
So, Sheriff Hood... what is he up to this week? He is up to his eyeballs in red bone bodies, or at least two of them, out at the Proctor place. I love this moment between him and Kai where he's like, look, I don't care if you guys are going to tear each other apart. Just hurry up already. Just do it. So
that's really inconveniencing my day.
Dealing with it right now. And also, just like, the sooner it's over, the sooner we can all move on.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to have to deal with these guns on my streets. My life is very, very difficult because of you and your war right now. I loved this sequence on the Kanaho Reservation. I loved when he turns to Billy Raven and he's like, we need to go to the Kanaho Reservation. He's like, we can't do it. He's like, what? I do it all the time. Which is just so perfectly Sheriff Hood.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He had a lot of really good lines this episode, I felt like.
A lot of good laughs this way.
Yeah. Some good levity with him, especially.
Yeah.
I love it, too. I love it when Lucas gets funny. It's
yeah.
Really good.
Well, it's just so charming, and he's such an a-hole. It's just so beautiful. I love a good, beautiful a-hole. I think everyone got
it. Even, I mean, And we start with that when we introduce, I mean, when Hood is, we see him interview that former neo-Nazi to become, you know, the cop.
Bunker.
Which, can I just, you finish, I'll interrupt.
Oh, no, but, and, I mean, he's Hood is a straight shooter. So, we have the position filled. And he goes, oh, I kind of like him. Like, what?
I was kind of wondering about what the point of that scene was, and I feel like we may see Bunker again.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
I'm like, this has been planted here. It doesn't make any sense. I know it's setting us up for something else.
Well, we know we opened the season with the demise of Hondo, right, who is part of a neo-Nazi gang. So we know that there's neo-Nazi gangs in Banshee. Mm-hmm. And I think the idea is to beg the question of our viewers and our fans, who is this guy? Mm-hmm. Is he one of those guys? Yeah. Is he someone else? And why is he here? And what part is he going to play? Actually, he's going to play a significant part.
I'm glad to know that.
Yeah. Well, and also, what I love is every time we introduce a new character, it's not for no reason. There's always something very interesting about them, a story point that's going to stick in an audience's mind. And there's this conflict of, you know, if we were to hire this guy, if he was to be a sheriff, he's defending the side of right, but he's also done apparently terrible things. He is also a neo-Nazi. We have to wrestle with that as viewers.
He's wearing his sins.
Right. And what I love about that is, as viewers, we have to learn to love this guy in spite of what he did. There is a conflict there that's very, very interesting. It's something I haven't seen before.
Yeah, also he would have to gain us as a viewer, our trust.
Yeah.
Mm. He does.
He's well-spoken. He has been doing some reading in prison.
I also want to quickly point out, he and Siobhan, he's kind of pushing towards, like, you know, like, hey, I'm not opposed to moving in together. You were talking about me moving last week.
You could tell that she said that. It was one of those times, like, where, like, if you've been in a relationship and you kind of, like, let out, like, an I love you too quickly or something like that. Or she sort of let it out and then, like, maybe realized that she said that and was like, oh, I'm not pushing for that. But then it was nice to see him be like, well, it's okay if you push a little.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He's very comfortable. He's happy that there's finally something that feels pure. We had that kind of relaxation last week, this sort of calm before the storm of, like, we had this month where nothing bad happened.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And now we're about to get a whole lot more bad. That's a terrible way to phrase anything.
It's good that you guys are picking up on that, because we really wanted to give the audience and, you know, Lucas a time to settle in, right? Yeah. And we wanted you to feel like, well, maybe he might be settling in while everyone else is going topsy-turvy.
And yeah.
But, like, she is definitely an anchor, you know, for him in the show, and it's real.
Yeah.
Yeah, I kind of wondered about that, too, just because, you know, often in the stories like this, or like Mad Men or something, where they're, like, having to sort of pretend to be somebody else, they're never really truly satisfied, but he seems fully satisfied, and I'm like, I'm buying this, and I like it.
Mm-hmm. He doesn't know any different, though. I mean, you realize, like, this is his first relationship he's had since pre-prison.
Yeah,
that was Carrie / Anna. Like, this has got to be heaven, in a way. Mm-hmm. Just to have any normalcy and affection and intimacy.
I think so. That's what we're trying to do. I mean, that was the idea with the intercut from last week, actually, when we were kind of cutting back and forth between Stowe and Carrie and Siobhan and Lucas. The idea was, when you were with them, you actually feel like you're in a normal life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Even so, I love this thing. Originally, you know, he says, let's go to work, deputy, or something like that.
Yeah.
And originally, as scripted, he was going to get up and they were going to go to work and get their badges on. I was like, you know what? You're in that, like, honeymoon phase. So why don't you get back to bed? And I loved it. And then they did that. And I was like, oh, my God, that's so much better. Because that's where they are at in their relationship, is like, screw it. Let's just get together.
Yeah. So we get onto the reservation, and we meet Amy and Yaz, who are of the Kanawha Police Department, where Billy Raven used to work. Obviously, they're not welcome on the res anymore, or Billy's not welcome anymore. Sheriff Hood has never been welcome. I have to imagine that no one's forgotten the last time that he came to the reservation and really screwed shit up for everyone.
Yeah.
I love this character of Yaz, who, like, that was a question on my mind last season when we had this murder investigation of, like, Who runs the res? Why is there no police involved with the reservation? It's like, oh no, he just doesn't care.
Yeah.
He just doesn't care.
He's just super, super lazy. And you were telling us something about that off camera. Yeah.
The actor is a great actor, mm-hmm. you know, from Florida. He's a Cuban American, and he has a strong accent. In his audition, it didn't really come through. But when we were actually running the scene, in particular, when we were shooting Aunt Star's side, he just kept coming through, and it just created this sort of weird tension on the set, which really comes through actually in Ant's performance, because he's seriously frustrated, and he's got this like kind of wry smile, which is laden with like, I'm gonna kick this mm-hmm. guy's ass, because he really feels that way.
Yeah.
And I did too a little bit.
Hey man, art imitating life.
Yes. It was so funny. But what was good about his performance is that he did play it completely flat, mm-hmm. which is mm-hmm. exactly what we're trying to say with that character. Is he's flat. He's not going to give you anything yeah. which is very frustrating.
Yeah,
which is why Billy Raven left the res. You know, mm-hmm. not going to get anything done.
Yeah. Well, he also said that I had to get my family out mm-hmm. of there. Yeah. Is there some sort of corruption aspect of that as far as why he left?
Look at the Red Bones. You know, mm-hmm. look at Little Stone. Everything is just not good. You know, that's the reason why we had that big drive up scene. Mm-hmm. You know, we really wanted everyone to get another look at how shitty it is to mm-hmm. live yeah. on the reservation, yeah. and how like it's just not getting better. So they got to get out.
Mm-hmm. I love that Billy says that, because it just made me feel like everyone in this episode in particular, but in the story, has hard choices to make. Mm-hmm. And they suffer the consequences of every choice, even if it was the right choice. And so for Billy being isolated from maybe his family or friends, mm-hmm. but knowing that it's the best choice for his family, you see a lot of that of kind of getting out of the ghetto, mm-hmm. where, you know, people rag on you for leaving, even though that might have been the best thing for you, the best thing for your family, but to leave them behind, it's like crabs in a bucket. No crab will ever let another crab jump out of a bucket. They will pull him right back down.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so to see Billy facing that, willingly with Sheriff Hood, I think is really interesting. It's a great way to tell that story.
Well, mm-hmm. he kind of has no choice when yeah. Sheriff Hood decides on something.
But he doesn't fight him. He doesn't say, you know, you really can't do that, and this is what's going to happen to you, and blah, blah, blah. He mm-hmm. goes, okay, I'll take you.
I mean, I would say it's a little more complicated than that, but you're right. He doesn't put up much of a fight, even when they go to this bar and just start a big old fight. I love the character of Amy and this moment where Sheriff Hood, I think he asks her, do you know Chayton Littlestone? Or, like, what do you know about Chayton Littlestone? And she looks to Billy Raven and she's like, are you kidding? Is this guy kidding?
Yeah.
Because obviously, if you're a member of the Kanawha Police Department, you are very, very aware of Chayton Littlestone.
Yeah.
He's been causing trouble for a long time.
For a long time. And I'm very curious, we're going to see her again, yeah?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, she's around. Yeah.
Great.
and you know, Chayton's causing trouble. He's on the reservation, you know, in the woods somewhere, but not far from the reservation. Right. So.
And I love that
it's Indian land. They got to take care of that.
I love that we kind of get Lucas again being cheeky, but when she says, if you know what's mm-hmm. good for you, and he's like, do I look like a guy that knows what's good for him? Like, she's going to get to know him and his ways.
Style. Yeah. I'm very curious, because I have to imagine everyone on the res knows at this point that the Red Bones... Well, actually, no, because the police department doesn't know that they have all these assault mm-hmm. weapons. Yeah. But I have to imagine that most of the reservation must be aware that he's building
an army.
I'm sure
everyone knows.
I'm wondering why more people aren't joining him. Do they know? Think like he's...
I wouldn't say that. I mean, there's nothing that tells us that every one of those guys at the Dog Iron isn't, you know, hanging out with Chayton in the woods.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing tells us that. You know,
okay.
You know. We don't know who's involved.
Interesting. I want to talk about Gordon, mm-hmm. who we get to spend some serious quality time with this week as we watch him slowly, I think, hit finally rock bottom yeah. after a season-long slide.
Fingers
last
crossed.
Year.
He's day drinking, and that's not good.
Well, he does say that he tells, what's our DA's name?
Allison,
thank
Allison
you.
Allison Metting.
Yes. You know, like she says, are you off the pill? He's like, yes, I'm seeing everything with crystal clarity. And he just kind of doesn't look like it at all.
mm-hmm.
Looks like he's worse for the wear.
Well, when you're coming down off of something that you've been taking for such a long time, your body has to adjust.
He's definitely taking steps. And, you know, Russ and I spoke a lot about that too. It's like, from his character's standpoint, is like, it's one step at a time, and then he goes cold turkey, and it sucks. Mm. And that's, I really wanted to sort of, again, sort of cinematically, I only shot that from a profile angle, and I did what's called short sighting, like where I only had, you know, the nose of Russ on one side and the nose of Afton on the other, because they're not connected, and I wanted the audience to look at them with absolute clarity, with the exception of that opening piece where I took a very wide angle lens and kind of like threw it up his nose when he was sitting there to say, like, he's really having a hard time.
We've got this plea bargain for Kai Proctor that she's very, very against, and he's just allowing to happen. And this is coming from a guy who was pursuing Proctor pretty aggressively for a long time, and it's sad to see him in such a state where he almost just doesn't care. He's so wrapped up in his own recovery that he's letting that slide.
I think what's hard in Banshee is when you're watching the show over years, you forget that only months have gone by, and this guy's poor life has like over years from fandom, but over in their life it's only been months. Like, it's, you know, 8 months or 9 months or something like that. It's like his life has fallen apart in less than a year. It's really bad.
He had a wife who he thought he knew who she was. He had two children. His life looked really, like, you know, hunky dory.
It was perfect.
And then, like, there's some weird sheriff that comes to town and, like, what? Oh, and my daughter is his daughter, you were a what now, and you killed how many people, and your dad's a gangster.
I started drinking. My son, and
by the way, where is the son? Is he unavailable for shooting?
Max is around.
He's around. He's a sick kid. He's at school. He's not at school. He's in bed. When we've seen them, it's, you know, literally he's been upstairs. It's been late.
Now, how we're going to notice the mayor's, you know, mayor's recovery, you know. It's not, maybe it won't actually be through, I feel, dialogue or even really a scene, but we're going to see, like, a picture hanging on his wall, or we're going to actually see a piece of furniture or a box, you know.
Well, I think that's what we got in that last moment where we see the photos on the mantle.
Finally, and I feel...
That was the idea, is that, that was the whole scene was about transition, and literally Jenny the hooker was really a metaphor for his rock bottom. And so the idea in the editorial of that sequence, that it was beautifully done by Amy Fleming, in the concept of that sequence, is that this is about him finding himself at the bottom of the pit, at the bottom of the abyss, and turning his back on it, really. And so the box, again, was metaphorical for him digging into his life, like looking into the abyss and finding hope. And that's why the last thing you see in that scene are his children, which are hope.
I really liked that because it was just evident that finally Gordon makes a good choice, a choice that's good for himself. But also, I loved the jump cuts, and you said something about the way you guys edit.
Which is always subjective. So there's a term that we use in the movies and TV called, you know, subjective filmmaking or subjective cutting, which means that we try to, you know, frame a shot, edit a shot, create sound for a shot that lives with inside the subjectivity of the character. And I think Greg Yutanis and Jonathan Tropper established a series that really embraces that from an editorial style. And what that means is it's not jump cuts, it's actually psychological cuts. Okay. So again, in this Gordon scene, it was really about him digging into the box, which is digging into himself, and finding at the bottom of rock bottom hope. So how do we do that? How do we show that? We intercut non-linearly the visit of the hooker Jenny, and we sort of show how he's feeling, and we could finally get to the resolve, which was what the beginning of the scene was about in the first place.
It's powerful.
We see him looking at those pictures, which we don't show because we have to save that and let him find hope.
I also just want to throw in there, Gordon, you're so much better than being gross with Allison.
I know. Who
you know is not interested. That was such, like, a weird, cheesy, come on, buddy. So I'm just so glad that he's not in that place anymore.
Oh, we love that on set, too. We were like, that's so cheesy.
Maybe you could teach me to cook.
And let me tell you, as a woman in business, I used to be in sales, that stuff happened all the time of, you know, someone getting a little too comfortable and then saying something that you're just like, you know, you can't unsay that. Now you just said that. Really? This is awkward.
That's
it. He can't unsay that.
No, good. And finally, we close on Deva coming to see Sheriff Hood, who, it's just, I feel like it's weird when you've just met your dad, and now dad's shirtless. and you're coming into Dad's shirtless apartment. I don't know. It just was a little strange for me. She wants to spend time with him.
I don't think it's that weird.
I mean, I think it's a little weird.
But if you just met your dad,
he's taking a nap. He was taking a nap.
Okay.
She comes over uninvited.
He didn't have any shoes on. Yeah. I just didn't have a shot of the shoes. I didn't, you know. Okay. I promise he didn't have shoes on.
You know what?
A man should be allowed to be shirtless in his home.
Fine.
It could have been a lot worse.
What you didn't see is I opened the scene with him in bed, mm-hmm. asleep, and there's a knock at the door. So we just kind of trimmed that shoe leather, as you like to say, for time. So you didn't see that. But that was the setup, is that she wakes him up in an afternoon nap. Mm-hmm. So not expecting.
She gets the result that she was not hoping for. He's taking Gordon's plea from last week clearly to heart. And it's a hard scene to watch, because it's obvious that he wants to know her and that he wants to spend time with her, but he has to let her down to protect Gordon.
Yeah, and perhaps ultimately, does he think like maybe he's not good for her? Maybe Gordon is going to be the better father to her, at least.
I don't think Aunt Star would tell you that this entire show for him is about finding a sense of place, like who is Lucas Hood? Mm-hmm. Where is my place? Mm-hmm. And I don't think he knows where his place is yet.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I really thought it was powerful, the use of distance between them. Mm-hmm. Like Aunt Lucas Hood keeps his distance from her that seems really painful, mm-hmm. that he does not want to have that there. She clearly is reaching out to him, and he's backing away, mm-hmm. and he's staying there, and it just... It kind of hurt to think of a kid that really is reaching out that needs help, and he asks if she's okay, and she says, no, I'm not okay, and he's not doing anything about it.
Yeah. That's all of that emotion is being pulled inside, you know, which is why when she walks out that door, he punches that bag, because it's crushing him. Mm-hmm. It's crushing him, he's taking it all.
Yeah, I like her bringing that line back to him that you said you stayed for me, and even when he sort of says there, like, you know, I just want to make sure you're okay, like... I wasn't able to fully tell if he believes that or if he's just telling her that to kind of like, you know, like white fang her a little bit, like go to your dad and like, you know, like I'm not the one for you or something to that effect.
I think it's both.
Okay.
It's both.
Yeah. We end the episode on a cliffhanger as Sheriff Hood opens the door to a gun in his face. We don't know who's wielding it, but looking at the scenes for next week, it seems like he's in a whole heap of trouble.
Mm-hmm.
Not good at all. Mm-hmm. Before we go into predictions, just because we have a couple minutes here, I just want to turn to you, Lonnie, and ask you a few questions about your time on the show. What's most interesting to me about how this show is run and produced is it's a small stable of directors that direct the entire series. And I guess I wanted to know, how collaborative is that process? Who decides who's getting what episodes? Do you talk to the other directors? Do you trade ideas?
Definitely. You know, Greg Gutanis, who plays our showrunner, he's a dear friend of mine and a great creative voice, is a big sort of... champion of the director and the voice of the director, and he believes that the director has a voice in television, which is not the typical thing. He believes that voice is sort of shared with the writer, and so as a result, he's constantly pushing us to talk about how we can use the cinematic format, editorial, sound, music, cut, just every little trope that we have, lighting, all of those things. How do we use that together as a team to make the show better? So what happens is we shoot these shows in blocks, these 2-hour blocks. So when we get to North Carolina, we actually have time with one another. So I have time with Greg leading up to my episodes. I did the first two and the last two. Mm-hmm. And then as I'm in production, the next director is coming in and I get time to spend with them. And the other great thing that I had the opportunity of doing this year is I actually shot 70% of all the second unit action scenes.
Oh, wow.
Because I was the what they call the producing director on set. And so as a result, I got to be the hand of Magnus Martens and the hand of O.C. Madsen, who's one of the big directors on our show, and really see how they work and become their hand. And Greg's always about that. He's like, well, how does O.C. feel? And as a result, I think the show gets this cohesive look because we're constantly exchanging ideas about the subjectivity of the editorial, the use of the lens baby, which is that that narrow focus lens tool that you see on the show all the time, and what that's supposed to represent is sort of that the tension builds and the psychosis of the characters. We all use that because it's a part of the language of the show. So how do we get together? Do we get together? Why is it such a small stable of directors? Because we really kind of get what Greg and Jonathan are up to, and as a result, we kind of become hands of each other, and we refine each other's format and learn from each other. That's great.
That's fantastic. Yeah. We are sitting with an Emmy Award winner here, yeah, right?
Yeah. Congratulations.
You have a history in visual effects supervision, right?
Yeah.
So you won your Emmy for Firefly, which I hate to say I've never seen.
Which is one of the greatest shows of all time.
I'm so sorry. But I do know, I'm familiar with Drive, the movie, mm-hmm. right? And of course, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, like, whatever. And Battlestar Galactica. I'm just wondering how that past informs your direction. And also, if you could give us a quick, what does it mean to be a visual effects supervisor?
Okay, so not Drive the movie, it was Drive the TV series.
Oh, sorry, there was a TV
series.
With
Nathan Fillion and
yes, Tim Minear, who was a co-creator of Firefly. It's okay.
Me.
So, that was 7 years ago. It was mm-hmm. my last job, actually, as a visual effects supervisor, and that was actually on Drive, which was also nominated for an Emmy. It was the first television series visual effects nomination that came from something that never aired on TV. It only aired on the internet.
Oh, wow.
It was the first internet that got that's
amazing.
I watched that nominee. Show, and I loved that show, and I was bummed. It got canned after, like, 3 episodes?
Yeah, yeah.
It didn't make any sense to me.
It was wild, but it was a big time for the internet because mm-hmm. it was the first time they ever got nominated. So what does it mean to be a visual effects supervisor? Back in the Joss Whedon days, it was a little bit smaller and tighter in terms of what we were expected to do. But on Buffy the Vampire Slayer, which was my first job out of college in 1997, mm-hmm. was make vampires turn to dust.
Yeah.
And back in the day, what that meant is we would photograph different explosions of dust and elements and things, mm-hmm. and then we would composite them into a green screen and a mm-hmm. background plate, very simple. And then as time went on, we got better and we got 3D tools and CGI became a big prominent thing. And when we got around to Firefly, which I won the Emmy for, we used CG to an extraordinary mm-hmm. extent. And what we did on Firefly, I think it was, which you'll see once you watch mm-hmm. it, I mean, besides it being an incredibly intimate, great little family Western weird so mashup good. Thing, this is Joss, we really wanted to go for a point of view in that show that actually presented sort of an intimacy for the viewers to let them feel like they're actually a part of the family. Mm. So that actually carried over to visual effects. So what we did in space is we said, okay, well, there's a handheld camera in space.
Yeah, it's one of the best parts.
And that there's lens flares, and if there's a camera, then there's an operator who's operating the camera mm-hmm. in CGI. So what that means is there's flaws. So now you go to get a spaceship, but you might miss the shot, then you have to reframe mm-hmm. and then refocus, or you might get a lens flare, or all of those things that are now like sort of cinematic normalcy that all yeah. came from Firefly, wow. which was then matured on Battlestar Galactica, which we did right thereafter. And I say mm-hmm. I co-founded a company called Zoic Studios, and we're the ILM of TV. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so
wow. That's what and then my follow-up question was, how does that background inform your directing on Banshee or anywhere else?
Well, that comes from Joss Whedon too. Mm-hmm. Joss would say everything is about the story, every single thing. So he would say, find the story in your 3-second shot. Mm-hmm. What is the intent of that shot? And certainly going to school, and I literally say this at Mutant Enemy, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, mm-hmm. Angel, Firefly, mm-hmm. Serenity the movie. I was second year director on Serenity. Joss was my mentor. Mm-hmm. He really was. He mentored me as I kind of grew up in the business. And he would tell you and constantly how is doing what you do enhance the story from a narrative standpoint, and how does it enhance the characters? Like, what is it? And every department was expected that. So how does it inform me as a storyteller today? Thank you for asking. It's like it informs me because that's what we were trained to do, mm-hmm. which is like to look for the story. And I got into like being a visual effects supervisor because I wanted to be a director. And
so
I got out of college and I had made a movie and I did done visual effects at a company called Digital Magic way in the back. It doesn't exist anymore in 1997. And they had done the visual effects on my little movie. Mm. And so I got that job and I had a family and a thing. And then here you go.
Yeah. Well, congratulations.
Now there's Zoic Studios, three countries. It's all crazy.
That's insane.
Yeah.
Isaac, any questions?
Nothing. I'm just listening to I'm a huge, huge Firefly fan. Loved that series. I did find Serenity first and then Firefly and then thought, why didn't I watch this show?
And the craziest thing with that show is just, the ratings that it had that got it canceled then are, Empire, which just premiered. It's the highest rated premiere on broadcast in, 5 years. Those are the ratings that got Firefly canceled. It's crushing.
I know. It was crushing. And like Firefly, it's funny. I'd say that Banshee has a little bit of Firefly to it, and I'll tell you why. Banshee, as a unit, we're in North Carolina, and we are away from our families, and what we have is we have a nuclear family that we create with the cast and crew that are there, and very much like Firefly, even though that was in L.A., we kind of built this real strong bond around a great piece of writing with great performances, which gets you excited to be a part of what you're doing, which is, I think, what helps make a show like Banshee great.
Fantastic.
Is because we all really care about it and we care about each other. Mm-hmm. So as a result, all of that quality kind of gets pushed on the screen. And that was very much a part of Firefly. And I think if you ask any single cast member, any single crew member that worked on Firefly, if they wanted to go do it again, they'd say, yeah, I'm in. And I feel the same way. It's like if Josh said, hey, come on back, I'm in. Because it's like, it was so good. It was so
many
great
people
to
happy. He's
going to be busy maybe for the next 10 years, though. So,
yeah.
So we can dream. All right, I think it's time for predictions.
And now, your AfterBuzz TV predictions.
Okay, I'm going to be right up front, and I'm going to say it is unfair for me to make predictions because I have now seen over half the season. I've seen 6 episodes, and all I will say, I'm not going to spoil a single thing, all I will say is you have no idea. You have no idea. That's, and you already know that you have no idea, but the no idea that you thought you had, delete it, because you have less of an idea than you already thought, and it's great.
So we're really going to make predictions.
Yeah, that's
then.
Like very, very encouraging before we make predictions.
You now. Have no idea.
Yeah.
Well, actually, you might.
Note,
I don't
following
know.
That.
I don't know what you think.
I mean, one thing that, I mean, we really didn't talk about them, but we really didn't talk about Sugar and Job, and I feel... You know, that so far has been the underlying arc in these 2 episodes. I do not want that to be the season arc. I want to do this job. I want to do it. I want to.
Oh, yeah.
I want this to happen. I want them to steal the money. I thought it was going to be this episode. It did not. I do not want this to linger throughout the whole season. Let's get Job and Sugar back. Let's do this job, whether it falls apart or it's success. I want to see, and I want to see the consequences of it.
I think we will. I hope so.
Yeah.
I'm not really going to make any predictions. I haven't watched it ahead because I don't want my heart to break too early. But I just think we're going to see this furthering of difficult decisions, the deepening of characters, of the situations they get into, and the choices they have to make, the behavior that they exhibit, and that everyone seems like they have a split personality in Banshee. Like, no one is as they seem, and no one is just one way.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's going to be fleshed out the rest of the season. Yeah. I'm thinking in particular of Deva right now in this moment, but also of some of our other characters that we're meeting that are newer.
Yeah. Well, I think the show in general is not what it seems. It seems like it's a show about, you know, sort of pulpy action and whatnot, but it's more than what's there. We're definitely getting into the heist. That's my feeling, which I absolutely want to see them, like, drilling through the door and all that stuff. And we got a thumbs up over there? Also, the man with the gun. Oh,
It's gonna be. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
Go ahead.
It's either Sugar or Job, and they have a gun to Sheriff's, you know, head and say, "Let's get this going. Let's get the job."
That's so out of line.
No, I'm serious.
It's like I want to say that there was like I mean, because we had the one agent die. I can't remember his name, but I think it's. It's got to be somebody, FBI, agent, something.
Gonna,
there was someone I saw, and I've been racking my brain trying to figure out who it was.
We saw the shot from the back, and there's a collar. Like, it looks like he's wearing a white collar.
It's somebody official, because there's somebody who's got to have followed up. I wish I could remember the name of the agent.
But neither Sugar nor Job has a
Yeah, they got shot in the house. I can't remember his name.
Yeah, played by Zelko Evanak.
Yeah, that guy.
From last season.
Somebody's following up on his mission, perhaps, and that's who's at the door.
Oh, interesting.
Okay.
I like that a lot.
Think of who it was.
Ah. Yeah. It's all right.
A Ukrainian gangster?
No.
Oh.
No.
He's talking about the agent that in episode 5 last season when they were in the house who got shot by the sniper. Yeah.
Yes.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. Someone might be answering for that. It's entirely possible.
I like
that theory.
That was pretty possible. Yeah. I feel like I'm getting good vibes.
Yeah. I guess what I'm going to say is based on just these 2 episodes, I really want to see played out over the course of the season. The thing I'm most interested in is what Kai's mother, in the process of dying, what that does to him. Because this is somebody who's already feels incredibly isolated and is incredibly dangerous, and he finally gets to connect with his mother, who shunned him so long ago, and to have her go. I can't even imagine what that would do to somebody as dangerous as him.
Send him off the edge, probably.
Yeah, well, that's what I'm curious about. Anyway, folks, I want to thank you all so much for tuning in. I want to thank Lonnie for coming. It's been a real pleasure talking to you.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Where can the people find you online, Lonnie?
They can't.
On Twitter?
No, they're on Twitter. Oh, well, at L Peristeer.
At L Peristeer. Peristeere. And is there anything else coming up that you want to promote?
Nope.
Okay. Manas, where can the people find you?
You can find me actually on the website. I am the editor-in-chief of the website Restaurant Fiction and the iTunes podcast Restaurant Fiction, where we found a bar that features human breast milk. It was prominently featured in the movie A Clockwork Orange. It's called the Kurova Milk Bar. I would love all of you guys to check that review out, restaurantfiction.com. We will also be reviewing the restaurants and bars featured in Banshee on iTunes as well, so please look out for those.
Wonderful.
Awesome.
Oriana.
Well, as usual, you guys can find me on Twitter at Miss Oriana Leo or Instagram Oriana Leo. I'm all over the place on the web, on Facebook, but I'm also hoping to get production of Running Errands in Hollywood up soon, maybe with some people from Banshee that would want to ride around my car and for a deeper interview. So check me out, and I'll follow you back if you tweet me or Instagram me.
Cool. Isaac. Sweet.
You can follow me on Twitter at Isaac Johnson, Instagram The Isaac Johnson. I have a YouTube page, also The Isaac Johnson. There's a music video up there. And a short that you can watch.
Okay. And folks, I got to cover a Banshee fan event this past week and got to interview Jonathan Tropper and Anthony Starr and Ivana Milicevic. That footage will be going on the AfterBuzz TV channel, hopefully in the next week. You should be able to see it by the next time, by the time the next episode of our podcast airs. You can find me on Twitter at Matt Lieberman. And you can find me on the internet, youtube.com/MatthewDLieberman. Also on SourceFed and SourceFed Nerd. I want to thank you all so much for joining us, and we'll see you next week. Good night.
From executive producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the entire AfterBuzz TV staff, we would like to thank you for listening to the AfterBuzz TV Network. To watch or listen to other after shows and post comments or questions, be sure to visit AfterBuzzTV.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of AfterBuzz TV.
Banshees rule!
The views expressed herein are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of AfterBuzz TV or its owners or principals.